Welcome, everyone. My name is Michael S. Siever. You're listening to Equal Chance to Be Unequal, my podcast about unlocking human potential through helping people disconnected from their purpose, uncover and live their purpose.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of Equal Chance to Be Unequal. Today, I would like to welcome Lisa Barrington to the show. Lisa is an International Coach Federation certified coach, workplace and engagement strategist, and speaker with over 25 years of experience. She's worked with organizations spanning from small not-for-profits to Fortune 100 companies in healthcare, higher education, finance, and technology. I really, really love that Lisa has a strong background, a unique blend of business and psychology education. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things that she's doing with continuing education here in a minute. She's leveraging her expertise in workforce strategy and organizational development, and she has partnered with organizations to increase leadership effectiveness, deepen employee engagement, and improve business results. She's definitely drawing upon her experience as an adjunct university instructor, and she teaches business, leadership, and organizational development courses there. You can find Lisa's work online as it's been published on Forbes Online and the Association for Talent Development. And we've also seen content come from Lisa and be pushed out to various outlets, including the Associated Press, U.S. News and World Report, CNBC, Zenefits, and Fast Company. She's been able to speak about organizational effectiveness in front of several audiences, which we can dive into. Lisa is currently a doctoral candidate and completing the dissertation requirements for a PhD in organizational psychology. She does have a bachelor's in science of business administration and a master of arts in organizational management. So you see a theme running through Lisa's education. She is the certified coach through the International Coach Federation, as well as a board certified coach. We talked about in the pre-show a little bit of her connection to being a senior professional in human resources through the Human Resources Certification Institute, and she is a senior certified professional through the Society for Human Resources Management. And as I was looking at her website over the weekend, right, she does have certifications to do the MBTI, as we talked about, Forbes Coaches Council member, and she's based in Metro Phoenix. So with that, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. I'm really happy to be here today.
Yeah, thank you. As I was looking over and reading through the bio, did I cover the most important pieces? Would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think you covered the most important pieces. Okay. I would add that in addition to owning my own organization in which I work with organizations and I work with individuals, I also partner with a couple of other organizations to deliver similar services. That way we're more available both here in Phoenix, nationally, and even internationally.
Nice. Well, that's fantastic. Okay, good. And you and I were talking in the pre-show about the various things that we have in common with regards to coaching and professional associations, organizations we've partnered with, given presentations to. You know, turn back the clock a little bit if you can, Lisa, and kind of walk us through your journey to today and how coaching and consulting and helping other people has become such a big part of your life's work.
Thank you. I think that's great. And the truth is, I've always known this is the work I wanted to do. So I'm one of those rare people. And interesting, I have to coach people on figuring this out often late in life that always knew this. Back in high school, I used to talk to my fellow students. They would come to me for advice. It was a big joke. And Lisa the therapist, they didn't use the word coach, but whatever the equivalent word was back then. So by the time I was a senior in high school, I had this sense that I wanted to work with helping people, but I didn't want to be a psychologist. I didn't want to be a therapist. And that's how I landed on business degrees and ultimately spent a lot of time in human resources, because it was my way to, in my mind, legitimately help people, but in a work environment, in a business environment. So I'd say that that's where it started. That's where the degree and the focus started. I pretty much got into human resources work almost immediately out of my undergraduate degree and spent my career doing that, focusing in different areas of HR, and ultimately recognizing after doing every type of HR you can imagine, from compensation to benefits to consulting to employee relations investigations, some of the stuff that's not as desirable and fun. Every time I found myself doing this traditional organizational development work, the work of helping leaders, the work of coaching leaders, I realized that that's where I wanted to spend the rest of my career. So I would say I spent the last third or so pretty much only working in that space or specializing in that space. In addition to doing the work, I really wanted to make sure that I gained additional education in that area. Mm-hmm. So went back to school, got a master's, and also went back to coaching college, if you would call it that, and got certified in coaching.
If you don't mind, Lisa, expand a little bit upon some of the things that you picked up in your Master of Arts in Organizational Management, because it sounds like a relatively specialized degree, but I'd love to be able to hear a little bit about maybe what you can remember learning there, how it directly affected your work right after receiving it.
So I'm going to be very honest. I went back 8 years after my bachelor's, and I'd already been a director of human resources for two organizations. So it wasn't that I learned that much in the coursework, because some of the coursework overlapped with the bachelor's, and some of it was somewhat new, but the experience seemed to be more relevant. I would say the most learning I gained in that program was writing the thesis.
Nice.
And it wasn't really the writing of the thesis, because then you just become more academic, right? So really what it was about is the topic I chose and the area of study that I selected became my lifelong passion, and I'm still the area of focus. So what happened is I had just changed organizations about halfway through my program or so, and I had to pick a thesis topic. And that this organization, your thesis had to be first-hand research, and it had to be approved, and then you had to write it up, do the research, etc. So I was looking for a topic that I had a good deal of passion about and that my organization would approve. And I had this strong interest in, back then we called it employee satisfaction. And I was working on designing the first, back then, employee satisfaction, they call it engagement now, survey for this particular organization. And because it was the first one and there wasn't data and I needed to compare historical data, I knew I couldn't use that. So I looked at what existed and what could I study going forward. And they had an exit interview program in place. And I thought, this also measures a level of employee satisfaction. So I did my thesis on that topic, exit interviews, which really, again, is a measure of engagement. And that was the beginning of me having this passion for measuring and try to improve engagement in the work.
I love how society is attempting to track similar things and ideas, but we change the terminology of it, satisfaction to engagement. And so at this particular point in time, was any of the work that Gallup does, was that like available or was that more recent?
Gallup became, so this was, I'm going to date myself, but I'll be honest, yeah.
That's okay.
This was back in 91 when I was doing this work. So Gallup's work came a little later, but not that much. It was in the 90s. It was in the later 90s that they had been doing employee satisfaction work since the early 90s. But really, we started to see the data later in the 90s.
I love it. Okay. And thank you for being transparent in that way, Lisa. Your age is completely irrelevant to me. I just love the experience there, because you're definitely ahead of your time in wanting to know how that really impacted people. I mean, I was just kind of wondering, like, when you turn back the clock to the late 80s, 90s, early 2000s, kind of looking at and saying, was employee engagement better then in America than it is today? And I don't know if there has ever been metrics to be able to turn back the clock that far to wonder if it was or was it not. Did you ever see anything around that period of time to know if it was or wasn't?
I can tell you that earlier in the 2000s, leading up to about 2013 or so, we had higher engagements. So engagement kind of started to hit record lows, at least from when Gallup was measuring it. Not that Gallup is the only organization that does this, but let's face it, they're the largest organization that does this, and they have the largest database, one of the largest databases. So yes, we saw higher engagement, absolutely, up through about 2013 when we started to see a drop off.
Wow.
It stayed low to about, well, right now, it's still fairly low. We're still seeing very low engagement. Somewhere less than 20% of workforces are reporting, on average, highly engaged workforces.
And it's amazing to me, because I remember recently reading the 2017 version of Gallup's State of the American Workplace Report, and having it say that there was only, you know, in America, 33% of the American workforce was engaged, and I think the number was 13% globally. And those are just such striking statistics to consider, to think about, is that there are basically seven people of every 10 inside your organization that really don't want to be working with you. And that's just striking.
Absolutely. And there's so much data that shows what that does to an organization in regards to losses, lower productivity, lesser discretionary effort, lower retention, which there's a lot of data to show the cost of turnover. So there's a direct cost. And Gallup estimates, and I'm going to throw this number out and I'd have to verify it, but it's somewhere between about $450 to $650 billion a year mm-hmm. in losses associated with low engagement.
Yeah, I think I've read that similarly, right? It's a national statistic, but it's a really staggering one. And I don't know the size of the American economy, but you know what, it must be what, 14, 15, 16 trillion. So when you think about a $500 or $600 billion hit, that's a really significant number.
Yes, it is. That's what they can measure. There's got to be costs that are less measurable, immeasurable. I mean, how do you measure discretionary effort? They're measuring things like absenteeism, turnover, losses like theft, lower productivity. I think they're also measuring shareholder value and other such things. Those are things that are concrete to measure. I think there's a lot of less concrete things that also cause some loss.
I agree. And because we don't have any type of a way to track it, we just don't know. But we can assume, because these engagement statistics are low, that it is pretty darn challenging. So in the 90s-ish, we're looking at, you're doing some research that's clearly ahead of its time by trying to assess from exit interviews, you know, what can we do to figure out satisfaction or happiness? Were there things that adjusted for you in the late 90s or early 2000s, where now that there was a little bit more of a focus on this, could you apply it differently in any of your work scenarios or with your clients?
I could. And I would say part of it was, of course, the learning, but a bigger part of it was the fact that in 1997, I joined American Express.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about being ahead of their time. That organization was 10, maybe 15 years ahead of everyone else that I was aware of and since have worked for in regards to engagement, in regards to how to attract and retain top talent. They really understood it. So I was able to take what I had started to learn in my studies and then work for an organization that was doing, which was ahead of its time, 2 annual surveys a year,
wow.
Spending a tremendous amount of effort on working with groups of people to analyze the data, improve the areas where there were gaps. In fact, back then, and I don't know if it's still current, but back then and for many years after, because I worked there for about 11 plus years, they also tied leadership, ratings, and compensation to that data. That's how strongly they felt
wow.
about it.
They were definitely ahead of their time too in that context, because like you said a second ago, engagement nationally was higher in the early 2000s or kind of the beginning of the 2000s, and it's dropped quite a bit since 2013. But then there are organizations like American Express that are just all stars and do it so well. Kudos to you for being able to work in an organization that did it so well, that gave you the background and context and knowledge paired with a master's degree and now paired with, you know, almost finishing this doctorate degree. The value that you can bring to any organization or individual that you're serving is astronomical. Like, it's amazing.
Well, thank you.
To me, that's important. And the certifications and the background that you have, I think is great. So when we think about 2008, obviously there's really, really massive adjustments kind of happening in the economy. Did you continue to do other research or look for other resources around 2008, 2010, 2012 with regards to employee engagement and how it worked then versus how it's working now?
I did, and what's interesting is there is probably a gap after. So when I left American Express, I then went to work for Arizona State University, and I led all of their organizational effectiveness work in addition to other departments too, but that was my area of focus. And at the time, 2008, not only was every other organization going through downsizing and budget cuts, ASU was hit extra hard because they were so dependent on state funding and so much of that was taken away. So as a result, although I was working with them to persuade them to do employee engagement surveys, it was a decision for and made perfect sense for financial reasons that they couldn't do it at that time. So I had to kind of put that passion aside and focus otherwise. So as a result, I focused on doing the things I knew that increase engagement. So we designed and implemented a leadership coaching program for the university that hadn't existed before, and designed both a supervisory and a director-level, mid-level leader leadership development programs, which included coaching in them, but we also had some classroom, online, all kinds of components to develop leaders, because I knew that developing leaders, making them more effective, would naturally improve engagement. Couldn't necessarily measure engagement, but could at least do the things that were necessary. So that's how I attacked it there. But I was lucky after that that I worked for another organization. And in particular, I think back when I worked for Banner Health, in the organization that I worked for, I was very involved in the measure of engagement and the efforts to improve engagement.
Nice.
And I did some work there that I had not really had the background or the opportunity to do before. And what it came down to is I worked in the medical division. And the chief medical officer said to me, you know, the data that's coming from the engagement survey says one thing, but anecdotally, I keep hearing something else from the physician. And you have to keep your physicians happy in the medical group. He said, so what can we do to get at that? And I said, well, certainly I could do focus groups and all that. But before we even do those, I think it makes sense for me to do what I now call coding and theme analysis on the comments. So back then I didn't call it that because I didn't know, because I wasn't getting my PhD yet. But basically it's where you take all the comments and you do word searches to begin with, and then you look for themes from those word searches. You look at the sentences around them and the discussion around those words and those sentences, and you start to build these codes of different themes and different topics, and you build a storyline. And I built a storyline for him. And from that storyline, they were able to make a significant change in the group, such that the next year, the engagement scores were dramatically increased.
Okay. Oh, that's fantastic. So I'm a big fan of pattern recognition and trying to find themes in data or human experiences, comments, body language, right? Whatever it is in my coaching practices and experience. And I just love that what you were doing was nearly identical. There was this need to really experience what the human was doing and what he or she was saying in his or her own words, and whatever metrics and numbers they were going to provide via the employee engagement survey. Whenever there's a disconnect there, we can go back to the words that are actually selected, typed in, or chosen, and we can find things. And I think that's where oftentimes where the action planning starts, is coming back to the most basic things about what a person feels he or she needs in order to feel happy at work. And as we've seen more recently with Gallup, they've got the Q12, and I've seen data from Arizona's top companies to work for, to Google's project Aristotle, which looks at what does it mean for Google to really engage their people. And the funny thing is that those little comments and how a person feels day to day is really the biggest determinant to a person being happy and engaged day to day.
Right. Exactly.
And so that to me is big kudos to you, Lisa, for trying to dive into that, figuring it out and finding out those themes, and then being able to convert it into a plan that actually engaged physicians. Because as you know, humans really dislike change. And so the physicians are definitely going through a major shift in society where they were kind of allowed to do and charge and be whatever they wanted for decades. And now we're moving to this kind of value-based model where we have to provide a service that works. It lasts for a long time. They can't come back in for some sort of episodic care. And it's a very, very different world.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, so many physicians, certainly the baby boomers and even many of the Generation X, grew up in an environment where they could work in private practice in smaller or mid-sized practices. And so many of those practices have been bought up by the Banners and the Dignities of the world. Mm. And indeed, that's a very different environment to work in a corporate environment than to run your three physician office.
Yeah, I totally agree. I have a couple of clients on either coast that are physicians. And so it's a really, really fascinating discussion for me, because I have a little bit of experience as a result of working in Banner Health myself and seeing it from kind of the system perspective. And both you and I have a lot of tremendous coaching experiences, but then to be able to look at a physician directly and understand what's going on in his or her mind and try to figure out how to get them to be okay with the change that's coming, knowing that it's going to impact virtually every area of their life in ways that they didn't expect when they were going through their medical program and when they were becoming a doctor and when they were doing all of the hard work it is to be that. It is such a significant shift that people are just not prepared for.
Absolutely. And it's not done.
No, we've got so much longer to go, but thankfully there are folks like you that are out there trying to help those individuals to accept the changes that society is essentially bestowing upon them. And this is the game, is that people will, from what I remember, people will tend to support what they help to create. And in many ways, these folks didn't get to choose what was kind of coming next. And so how do we get them involved in any type of change management process to make sure that they're going to reasonably support it, you know?
Absolutely.
And that's a challenge. So when we think, Lisa, about some of the folks that you help professionally, and we've already talked a little bit about your background and degrees and certifications, but what do you think is kind of your special sauce, or what makes you authentically you and how you go about coaching and consulting and helping a person or an organization?
I think that's a great question, because I think that when people are looking to work with a coach, there's a few things that go on. First of all, they want to make sure they're legitimate, because in the United States, you could be a high school student and call yourself a coach.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to make sure they're legitimate in that they've got some experience or some background that's relevant. So there's always that. But I think what's more important, and I bet you'll agree with this, is that connection. Either during that first consultation call, they feel a connection with the coach, they feel some level of trust, or they don't. And the way I go about doing that is I am absolutely myself and who I am. I don't put on the airs, and I don't speak some special language. I just speak in plain old terms with folks. And in my practice, I'm a practitioner of positive psychology and I'm a strengths-based coach. So in my opinion, I believe that my clients, whether it's their professional or their personal life, that they're going to go much further if they focus on their strengths than trying to just worry about fixing themselves.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that I ignore their gaps or I ask them to ignore their gaps. In fact, with my business clients, with my leadership clients, we do 360-degree feedback and we identify factors that could be obstacles, but we still make sure that we focus on their strengths and we stay more in that space. So I build my clients' confidence, but in an honest and genuine manner, to get them to a safer place, so when we start focusing on their gaps, they're more trusting, and we've got a trusting relationship. And that way, when they start questioning themselves, questioning their ability to make a change or get through a difficult time, I've got both the data and the compassion that's going to help them get through it and celebrate their strength.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, there's this really, really strong capacity to be able to convince a person to change, because some folks just really love data and logical facts and figures to be able to say, this is why I should change. And then there's these other folks that are a little bit more emotion driven, and they want to know that they're going to be safe, or that they're going to be kept in high regard, or some positive thing is going to happen to them down the road, because they're more driven by that emotion as opposed to the fact.
Right.
So, okay. So then give me a little bit of context, Lisa, about like change. Okay. So if we're working with an individual, we're building his or her confidence, do you use a specific process or methodology or idea around change management with the person directly, or maybe even with an organization?
So I definitely, when I'm working with organizations, I'm more process oriented. Mm-hmm. When I'm working with an individual, I base the approach based on their needs, their style. So we often start off with assessments, so I understand how they like to be coached, how they like to learn, what's going to prompt them to change. I ask them right in their initial questionnaire, if you're not doing what you're committing to do, what do you want me to say or do to you?
Nice.
Do for you?
Yep.
How do you want me to, you know, are you the type that wants to be gently prodded, or do you want me to get in your face?
Nice.
<Both. laughs> So with individuals, I don't use a particular process. When I work with career clients, I do, because there's a lot of things you have to do to manage someone's change in a career.
Yep.
But with general change, I don't. But with organizations, when I'm doing massive organizational changes, put together a very thorough and detailed plan that involves all the aspects of communication, of change management that you can think of, and it's very well documented what all those steps are going to be.
Good.
And how we're going about doing it.
I've talked to a handful of folks in the last couple of days that establishing and setting those expectations up front about what success is going to look like is really wickedly important to making sure that not only do we hit those metrics of success, but then there's also a belief in progress, or that there's a confidence that we're moving towards something that's better, in that we can celebrate small wins in some meaningful way. Humans just love to celebrate wins.
Absolutely. And I love that. Wickedly important.
I'm not even from the East Coast, but I'm using East Coast terminology.
And that's old East Coast terminology. Now,
it has been a while since I've been in New York City or even New Jersey, kind of in that area. I need to travel there more often. Maybe this upcoming couple of months that I hope to relax a little bit more, maybe I can sneak back there and listen to folks and pick up some of that terminology and use it here in Phoenix where we live. Maybe.
It'll get people's attention.
When we think about change, it is challenging. I don't know if there's a particular model that you've used, but there was I think it's William Bridges wrote a book called Managing Transitions a number of years ago.
Right.
And for some reason, it's a very personal thing, but to help a person let go, to get into the neutral zone, or to be on board with whatever's coming next, it's such an easy three-step thing to consider. And have you seen that kind of model or a simplified model of that work really, really well with individuals?
I think it does. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good point. So I actually teach a couple of courses where we have entire evenings of where we talk just about change management, both in the classroom and also in corporate environment. And I do bring in the models. I bring in Daryl Connor. I bring in Cotter also. So Connor and Cotter. And I, of course, bring in Bridges because his is pretty simplistic. And a lot of this is really based on older work that comes from the unfreeze, change, and freeze again. And
got it.
They've now started to talk about refreeze, but the original model is actually freeze. So a lot of it's based on that original work. And I think that it really depends on the client's needs. So you're absolutely right. With individuals, it tends to be simpler models that work. But I'm going to tell you, I've had some sophisticated executives I've worked with where that's too simple for them. And they crave something that's going to give them a little bit more meat. So that's when I start to bring in either Cotter or Connor, and we start to talk about some of the other models. I have them read some books. So I'm a big fan of starting a lot of my engagements with an assessment or two, and then a book or two.
Oh, okay. I like that.
Yeah.
I can imagine that your library of books is robust.
Yes, I love to read. And I love to recommend for my clients who are up for it to read.
So have you ever been able to, Lisa, have you been able to convince your children to read these books?
One of them. One of them I had my son read, and about part of the way through, he said, yeah, I don't think this really applies to me. And the whole point of the book was, if you say it doesn't apply to you, then it just shows that you're not ready to do this self-exploration.
Yep.
It's a book called Leadership and Self-Deception.
Oh, I've heard of that.
It's written by the Arbinger Institute. It's very simple. It's written as a fable. And, you know, it's a kind of like Pat Lencioni-style fable.
Yep.
And because it's written as a fable, it can really be read in a couple of hours. It's very easy, and the concepts are very easy to get. And I once gave it to an executive who was one of the best executives I ever worked with. I told him that repeatedly. And when I gave him the book, I wrote a note inside of it, and I said, I'm giving this to you because you already get it. And I think it's going to make you even better. And he got about halfway through, and he said, do you see me like this? And I said to him, oh, my gosh, it's the opposite. That's the point, is I can't give this to put people – this book to people who don't get it or aren't willing to do that deep exploration. It only works for people who will be vulnerable and are willing to explore what they could be doing even better.
Yeah. And so some folks are just ready for the message and some aren't. And I think we allow them the dignity of their own process. And when they're ready for the message, they will receive it.
Yep.
And I have an 18-year-old stepdaughter. To get her to read any of this content it's like completely foreign to her. And that's totally okay. So at some point, maybe post school for her, because she's up at NAU in Flagstaff right now, and maybe when she's done with some of her studies, maybe she'd be more interested in this once she actually gets into the workplace. But we allow folks the dignity of their process so that when they're ready to receive the information and how it can impact them positively day to day, then they will.
Yes.
We've talked about your background, your certifications, the degree you're working on now. You get to teach other leaders, right? You coach leaders. Were there any experiences along the way, Lisa, that were really, really transformational for you, that it was a great learning experience for you that you've now been able to not only catapult your own career, but also use as an example for many of the folks that you get to engage?
I think the answer is absolutely. There's so many. There's a couple that I would probably focus on, and in order to balance, I would suggest that there was one extraordinary success I had that stands out in my career. It's a very large success I'll talk about briefly, which gave me the confidence and taught me a lot. But also, I've had many times where I've stepped in it, where I've made mistakes, mm-hmm. all those little ones, because I don't know if I've made a really, really big, unfixable mistake, but all those little and middle-sized mistakes I made also became this catalog, this library of learning, kept building and emerging to what I don't want to do again and what I can help other people avoid doing themselves. So I would say that the major success that I still have learning from, and I think about this, I thought about this when you asked about change management, is, and this is now a long time ago, it became public, so it's no longer anything confidential, is when I worked for American Express in the late 90s into the early 2000s, they were looking at how could they, given the platform of everything they did with technology, how could they update and increase their capacity in their technology operations division, which included like help desk, desktop, mainframe, security, you know, information security, et cetera. And I was supporting them in a couple of year-long project in investigating how to do this and then implementing the change. And it affected many, many thousands of people. And in the end, it became that they decided to outsource the work that had been done inside American Express to another organization. And the final decision was IBM, but it took a few years to get through this. Hmm. And you can't hide this type of review, research, decision-making from employees. They did at the beginning, and they had to keep certain information from them because it was such a big deal. It ended up being a billion-dollar deal. The SEC could get involved in if indeed certain things were shared. But people showing up and reviewing your equipment and asking employee questions, you had to start to explain at some point. So we had to manage this extraordinary change, and I had never done anything like that, and nor had Amex. That I was in a really safe, secure job, and I was a single mom of two little kids who were in like kindergarten, and they offered me this opportunity to lead the HR part of this project and said, oh, and by the way, it's a big promotion, but it's a temporary assignment for a couple of years, so when you're done, you know, maybe there'll be something for you, maybe there won't.
Okay, scary, and, but good.
And I thought long and hard, and I was not a risk taker, but for some reason, there was something in me that said this is like the most extraordinary amount piece of work I could possibly do. So I made the decision to do it, and unfortunately, I had a loss in my family and had to get on a plane 2 hours after I said yes, so used my plane time to fly back east to literally take a pad and pen and design the structure for how I was going to do this work. Because it was in 26 countries, too. Mm. And I had not had the right, really good international background to understand what I was signing up for. So anyway, long story short, I decided this work really had three components. It had the change management component, obviously. It had the technical component of transitioning employees in 26 different countries to the outsourced vendor because we had made a commitment, they had made a commitment as an organization because they valued employees. They had made this tremendous commitment to try to retain as many of the employees and transition them to the vendor that they possibly could. And then the last piece was I needed to ensure the safety and security of the people, the physical equipment, and also, of course, of information because of what they did. And I put this together, and I came back, and I typed it into a computer, and I got back, sent it to my boss, and she said, this is what we have to do. This is it. Hmm. And we went on to do this entire project and succeed and get everyone outsourced. We kept our commitment. We did it with no increase in turnover, no increase in violence in the workplace, and no decrease in employment.
Wow. That is fantastic.
So much, but do you think I didn't make many, many small mistakes along the way? And you know, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's the great thing about human life is that through the mistakes and the failures and the little things that we would like to adjust or change, hindsight looking back, is that there are many blessings that come from those mistakes. And I don't remember when it was published, but there's a great TED Talk by a guy named Astro Teller. He is a director of Google's X program, which is their highly innovative arm. Right. And any time that there's a massive failure or mistake within the Google X program, like they throw a party and celebrate. And,
exactly. Yeah.
And to me, that's such a cool thing to do is that our society for a long time did not appreciate the mistake or the little things that we learned from it. Thankfully, we're moving to a place in history where we can be very open to these mistakes, right? We still have to do our job and manage details and do the best we possibly can, but we're human and we're going to make those mistakes. And so why not figure out a way to celebrate those mistakes in such a way that benefit everybody simultaneously? For a very long period of time, you were able to manage this program and this process and this transition. There were little mistakes that were made along the way, but because you learned from them and likely shared those learnings with other people around you, you were able to change how many thousands of employees across 26 countries, and to be able to not only manage the change process, make sure all the technical specifications were met, but then also make sure that the people and the information and content was safe. And that is a massive, massive undertaking.
It was, and it was some of the greatest learning I ever had, both the mistakes I made and the things that I did right and the things that I didn't know that I figured out. I think probably the greatest learning from all that is that I understood that I can take something that's a blank piece of paper, literally, and create solutions from there.
Yeah.
I don't know if I had that level of confidence before that.
A tremendous example. So this is kind of maybe a silly question, but so then when it was done, did they give you another job internal to Amex?
They offered me three different jobs.
Dang.
They were all at that level. Yeah, I know. They were all at the new level that I had gotten promoted to temporarily. So yes, and then and what was really cool is that's where I transitioned to a focus on OD. So the job that I chose out of the three was an organizational effectiveness development role in their finance organization, which I spent 6 years building all those programs and had the time of my life doing it.
Oh my gosh.
Amazing.
Yeah. That is so cool. Throughout all of these scenarios, one of the things that seems to be happening in our society, as we talked about at the top of the show, right, employee engagement is relatively low. There seems to be a little bit of a shift towards this individualistic kind of ego-focused approach to life where we kind of care about ourselves and winning ourselves more than we care about team and collaboration and consensus building. And I'm just a big fan of quality relationships when we think about groups like Lean In through Sheryl Sandberg or Weight Watchers or, you know, specific things in the health and wellness area to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? All of these groups have such tremendous success in getting people to change because there's a social connectedness component. There's a relationship that exists amongst the members of the group. And I just wanted to get a little bit of context from you, Lisa, about how social connectedness or the quality relationships that you had in your life, how do they play a role in getting you to success and to where you're at today?
A great question, because I agree with you. I think it's very important, and I think it's shifted dramatically due to technology and social. So most definitely. It's interesting because on the Myers-Briggs, I'm an ISFJ, so I am an introvert, although most people who know me don't think so, because I speak in front of classrooms and large audiences, and I have a lot of energy, but I gain my energy from being in a very small group or being alone. So as a result, I tend not to join a whole lot of groups and go to a whole lot of group meetings. My relationships tend to be lots and lots and lots of one-on-ones. So I agree with you. It's 100% true. For example, when I left corporate America and took my practice from part-time to full-time, all my first clients were former colleagues and former employers.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not, at the time, planned to take my business full-time at that point in my life. It was a decision that was a co-decision along with deciding to go back to school because it supported my ability to be able to go back to school. So I had not nurtured these relationships with everyone I've worked with since I was a manager at McDonald's in college. Some of my very close friends are from people I met, high school. I started McDonald's in high school, so I'm still close friends with those. I had not planned or recognized the value of nurturing those relationships all these years. And it ends up becoming the foundation for my business unintentionally, if it's not really ever my plan. So to this day, I enjoy staying in close touch with all of these people, but more on an individual basis. I have the coffees and the lunches and the dinners. And I think about one person, for example. I'll share her name, Patty Sadoff. I've worked with her in two different organizations. We first met in the 80s when we worked for a company called Charter Hospital. We've not only remained friends ever since, but we were colleagues again since then in another organization. And she's one of my best friends. In fact, when I adopted my children, she threw me my baby shower.
Oh, wow.
And I have dinner scheduled for next Monday. So I've known her since the 80s, and we still remain very close.
Those things are so important. So thank you for sharing that, Lisa. And it makes me think of Robert Waldinger's work, the Harvard study of adult development. And and how the very thing that leads to a long, happy, and healthy life is actually the quality of your close-knit relationships. And so we can talk all day about power, money, fame, traditional success, cars and houses and boats and things, and they matter to a certain level, but they're not the thing that is ultimately this underlying reason why we're happy. Lisa is an ISFJ. I am an ISTJ. And so a big dork for introversion. So at the end of a long day, there's that part of me that just wants to retreat and have time alone to think and kind of process all the blessings that the day brought me. You and I are quite similar in that way, Lisa, in that we want that little bit of time to kind of recollect our thoughts and recharge alone, if you will.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I imagine that if you have an interest in this topic, you've probably read some of Sean Aker's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, for me, when he talks about gratitude and he talks about these quality relationships over, as you just pointed out, over money and fame and other tangible accomplishments, there's so much data that shows that that's really where it's at, right?
Yeah. He does have a great TED Talk. It's quick, but it's also really funny. He's just a funny guy naturally. So you'll get a little bit of a story. But then at the end, he talks really specifically about positive psychology and ways that we can practice it on a day-to-day basis. And I haven't read one of the books. I know he's published a couple, but the one, I don't believe I read it, but I think it was called The Happiness Advantage, I believe is what it's called. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember reading a summary of it, but I haven't read the entire book. And it just, to Lisa's point, right, it's a really important thing, is that my brain, being a little bit more introverted, I can tend to think of things more pessimistically. And so I have to be very, very cognizant of how do I begin and end my day on a relatively higher note, right? Thinking about those things that I'm really, really grateful for and expressing blessings to the people around me, right? Expressing that gratitude to the people around me in a meaningful way. And so if you happen to have a brain that's like mine, don't be afraid to think about on a day-to-day basis, what are those random acts of kindness, or how can you send a thank you email or note to a person? How can you journal about the things that you do on a day-to-day? Are there other things like that, Lisa, that you've practiced or suggested that people that you work with practice to kind of keep practicing gratitude?
I do. I practice several of those. And one of the things that my husband and I do is, and we have to remind each other because we forget, is when something good happens, and it doesn't have to be a big good, it could be a little good, big good, we take a little piece of paper and we write it down and fold it up, don't share it with each other, and we have a glass bowl that we put it in. And then on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, this depends on our situation, we open them all up for the previous year.
Oh, that's cool.
And read them, talk about them.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
And the act of writing them, it's just the act of writing them, you know, forces us to be thankful and cognizant of that item or that action.
Yeah.
So for example, this might sound very silly, but we have these three grandchildren. They all live in separate places. So one of us last year wrote on one of our pieces of paper that we got all three of them to our house in the summer at the same time, swimming, and it was so much fun to have all three of them playing together.
That's cool.
So that was one of our things. Yeah.
And those are the things that matter the most in life, are those little moments where you just kind of sit back and look at the scenario and you just feel that massive, overwhelming blessing of like all the hard work that I've done has been passed on to the next generation and they're doing well. And that feels like the legacy is being carried on.
Yes. And an answer further to your question about, so how does this help my clients? Obviously, I share with them sometimes that story I just shared if it's relevant to them. But for them, sometimes it's around understanding the impact they've had on someone else.
Nice.
And you kind of inferred that. And sometimes when they're feeling bad or they're feeling they've made mistakes or they're struggling to recognize their strengths, especially with leaders who are been sent to me for coaching by their leader because there's a gap, there's a struggle, there's an area that they're not doing well in. And just to clarify, I don't work with leaders who are failing. I work with leaders who are either succeeding or new or who are just doing okay but having a struggle in a particular area and their leader asked them to get some help. So I might be working with the last of those three and they might be feeling bad, especially in the first few sessions. Oh my gosh, their leader asked them to get coached. They don't see that as a positive until they actually get into it.
Right.
And then they do. So we're working on this and they're feeling bad. So I start asking them a series of questions so they start to identify all the positive impact they've had, the good things they've done for other people, in particular those who report to them. And all of a sudden, this ability, it's not just about us having gratitude for what folks have done for us, but what we've done for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shifts the entire conversation, and it shifts their entire way of thinking.
Oh my gosh, yes. We just really need those reframes on a day-to-day basis. And I've found with some of the folks that I serve that we can get caught in specific thought patterns that are, of course, not really serving us, or they're keeping us stuck in the past. And there are little things that we can do daily to adjust those small little habits to be thinking more optimistically about what's possible. And that's challenging in and of itself initially when you haven't been taught or you don't have people around you that are doing that. We have to be really, really cognizant as coaches about recognizing the patterns in their behavior, but also the environment that they're in, to figure out how can we adjust that for them in a way that becomes sustainable. When you think, Lisa, about the challenges that your clients are encountering on a day-to-day basis, are there any patterns and themes that you're seeing in those challenges or potential solutions that you're offering them?
I do see that, and I'm sure you do too. I would say with some of my, I would bucket it three ways right off the top of my head. With some of my individual clients who are coming to me with career challenges, I'm working with some folks who are older or later in their career, so in their 40s or 50s, that's not old, it's just older than a young client.
Sure.
They're looking back and they're saying, you know, I've done this career because I had to, or I fell into it, or it worked, and I don't want to do this anymore, or I don't think I do, I don't know what I want to do. So they're having these challenges of they've gotten so far in their career that to make a dramatic shift and maintain their level of income is going to be a real challenge for them.
Yep.
So I see some of that with those career clients. I would say with individuals that come to me for personal coaching or just general coaching, where it's a combination, it's this overwhelming, nothing ever turns off, right? So it's kids, parents, family, technology, and nothing ever shuts off. So a lack of sleep, a lack of self-care, those kinds of things. And then I would say, and these are the clients I probably work the most with, is when I have leaders who come to me, and in particular, and the recommendation of their leader, of the executive who's recommended them, if they're coming to me, and we do a consultation, so they decide if they want to work with me or not, but they're still very hesitant. And frankly, the first few sessions, their defenses and their walls are very high.
Mm-hmm.
What's so amazing, though, is I build trust with them, and once we can get past these defenses, and, you know, assessments help, particularly 360s might help. But once we do that, I start digging into their relationships to get them to start identifying what's working and what's not. They can talk, I let them talk about personal, business relationships, whatever. And once they start seeing it for themselves and they start to hear themselves, we see a pattern, and I help them connect the dots, and the defenses start to go down, and it just changes them, not only in the work environment, but they start recognizing how these behaviors and patterns have interfered in their personal relationship.
Yeah. For folks, especially in society where there's so much massive change happening, if you happen to be a little bit more experienced or baby boomer or maybe early Gen X, having to make that change and not knowing what the heck you're going to do, super challenging. Or folks, I think like you and I, when we were kind of talking during our pre-show, which was sometimes my brain just won't turn off. And it's a blessing that people are reaching out to you and I, and that they would like our help. And so I feel in this need to be of service to them. But then sometimes I don't take care of myself well. I'm not getting to the gym enough, or maybe I'll eat the wrong food. And so we all have that in some regard. But it is a really, really significant challenge if nothing is turning off. And so sometimes we have leaders that want better for us. We don't understand or that the need for a coach isn't communicated to us well. And really thinking about how can we establish trust with that particular client to make sure that they realize that we're not doing it because the company is telling them to. We're doing it because we really genuinely want to see that individual succeed. That's a tough thing to get to, especially developing that level of trust with them at first. But kudos to you for doing it.
Well, really, it's ultimately up to them. And
yeah.
They have to open up their heart and become vulnerable.
Yeah.
So I give them the credit, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it's really cool, I have to say, it's really cool when it happens with teams. I worked with a team, a leadership team, this past year who came in not trusting each other at all, very low scores of themselves as a team. And by the time we worked through the program together over 6 months, the change was tremendous.
Mm.
Absolutely tremendous. And we did a post assessment and they could see it for themselves. And I continue to stay in touch with their executive and them themselves and continue to hear how really, and I know you get this being a fellow coach, is it starts with the self-awareness. They had to become aware of what they were doing and not doing with each other before they could start.
Yeah. I was facilitating a communications workshop yesterday, and during the actual workshop, this executive team continued to talk over one another. And I had even set boundaries at the beginning of the facilitation to say, hey, here's our ground rules. Does everybody agree? Everybody did. But it didn't take 30 to 45 minutes into the training. That started to happen pretty rapidly. About an hour in, I had to call a timeout and essentially call them out very specifically on their behavior. And so the next couple of hours of the training were far more productive because they were made aware of something that they just hadn't been aware of before.
Absolutely.
It is so important. So when you think about emotional intelligence and you think about a couple of components of it, you're looking at social awareness, but you're also looking at self-awareness. And once somebody can know that about themselves, that they're doing something that they didn't realize they were, that's where the real impetus for change is, because likely you can connect the change in behavior to some sort of future goal that they have set for themselves or for the business. And then they're going to want to do it because they're going to be rewarded for it.
Exactly.
These are the joys of our work, Lisa, is sometimes we have to be a little bit direct and abrupt with somebody who's struggling with something. But after the emotions subside, the positive change that occurs almost is always there.
I agree. I think that the two most important behaviors that I use, which seem so opposite, is being very direct with my clients and being very compassionate with my clients.
There is something about compassion or empathy that we don't really do well in society, and it would be lovely if we did. So we talked a little earlier about social media and how social media can be essentially a highlight reel of a person's life. And so we want to compare ourselves and our own ups and downs in life to what we're seeing on social media, to all the blessings that these other people have. But what we forget is that every single person we interact with is going through something we have no idea about. And if we could just take that quick step back and just honor the dignity of that person's process and the challenges that they're experiencing and things that they're going through, to say, although they're projecting a certain image, I know for sure something's going on behind closed doors. Why don't we pull them off to the side and show a little bit of that compassion or empathy to them to really figure out what's going on and more deeply establish and build that relationship? I just think that's a really powerful tool.
That's so beautifully said. Absolutely.
We need more of that. We need the Lisas and the Michaels of the world out there sharing that message so that people are willing to be vulnerable, share those things about themselves, and really help to come to some sort of common agreement about whatever there is they're discussing.
I agree.
Like I was sharing earlier, right, I was able to look at your website, and we think about resources and things that people can be utilizing to learn these things for themselves. I know you have on your website, because I went to the resources tab specifically at barringtoncoaching.com and was looking at the resources. And not only, folks, will you find the things that Lisa has published directly, but also some really tremendous book recommendations, assessments that we've somewhat addressed, from character strengths to Kiersey to emotional intelligence. And in addition to the stuff that folks can find on barringtoncoaching.com, do you have other things maybe that you would recommend, Lisa, as really important books, podcasts, you know, white papers, research, anything that you found in all of your studies and work?
So my initial answer is going to be, we're going to have to do a whole separate podcast.
Yes,
on that,
but we can do that.
But yes, I have some things that are at the top of my list that I'll share.
Okay.
So first I'll say I am a huge fan of Pat Lencioni and Marcus Buckingham.
Sure.
And they do a little different work, but there's some overlap. I've spent some time with both of them, and in particular, I spent some time with Pat and going to again in January. So I've been able to learn about their research and their particular experiences and the approach that they take to engagement and work on leadership effectiveness. So I incorporate their tools into my practice, and they've got some great books. I would say for Pat Lencioni, The Advantage, his most recent book, which is not like the others, which are all fables, it pulls the work of all the others together and then builds more work into it. It is outstanding. And Buckingham's, I think about Standout, that's a book he wrote on his own. And of course, the Strength Finders series are excellent books. I think for podcasts, it's only been in the last couple of years, and I'll explain this in a second, that I've really started to get into them. Because when I worked in corporate America, I used my drive time to do conference calls.
So
that way I wouldn't have to be at the office at 6 or 7 in the morning. I would use my drive time for conference calls. So I never really had that opportunity. And when I started my practice full time several years back, I realized that I had this drive time. And yes, sometimes I used it to make calls, for instance, to family back east. But more so, I started using it, filling it up with podcasts. So I do have a few favorites. I'm very interested in psychology. I'm getting a PhD in psychology. So yeah. I listen to the Core Brain Journal with Charles Parker, which is my favorite one on psychology. But for everybody else out there, people who really want to learn more about work, I like Adam Grant's Work Life.
Okay.
And I should probably listen to his stuff. He's just fantastic. And I listen to a few. I watch and listen to a lot of TED Talks, and I listen to them on podcasts. But my favorite podcast to listen to for fun, but I also learn stuff, is Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert.
Okay. I haven't heard of that one. I like it. Okay, I'll check it out.
Well, and I'm going to tell you, you have to have a certain attitude in listening to it, because he speaks very directly and very authentically. So it's not for some people, I will say that.
Sure.
Also, there's another one. It's one of the two organizations I partner with. It's called Stewart Cooper and Coon. The CEO of that company, Fred Coon, he interviews guests about everything in the workplace, from harassment to leadership to culture. He does a great podcast.
I like it. Okay.
You had also asked about like other things that I like to read. I am a research fiend, and I read everything I can get my hands on related to employee engagement. So we talked about it earlier, about that was the kind of the beginning of my interest peaked when I wrote my master's thesis. Well, that is my PhD dissertation topic. I'm doing a study on engagement.
Okay.
And it's going to be a qualitative study. And because I'm studying it, I had to collect the research over the last 50 years, and in particular over the last 5 to 10 years.
Wow.
That's out there. So I've read over 300 studies on the topic of employee engagement and lots of books. And for anybody who's really interested in the research, I find that Brad Schuch's and Arnold Baker's work is really intriguing and valuable. And then the last thing I would talk about is, you know, videos when I have time to sit down. Probably like everyone else in the world, I love Amy Cuddy's TED Talk on body language.
Yep.
And Brené Brown's on vulnerability, and she has a new one on shame. And I love both of theirs. And this is more just of a area of interest for me. I certainly wouldn't call myself an expert in this area, but I'm really interested in innovation. So I find myself watching videos on that topic. I've read a lot of Joel Barker's work. He's a futurist. But more recently, I've watched the 14 TED Talks by Nicholas Negroponte. He's co-founder of the MIT Media Lab. In fact, he was also co-founder of Wired Magazine.
Okay.
So he's just brilliant. And it's fun. It's just fun because, you know, I spend so much time on engagement and psychology and business. It's just fun to learn something else.
So. I totally agree. Right. And so being an active learner and wanting to constantly, right, absorb that information and figure out how you could plug it into some of the things that you're doing, right? Because we can always crash ideas together and bring out a different perspective that we hadn't considered before. So I like it. Okay, thank you for those. When you think about a person who's trying to break free from some sort of mold, either society's or something that they've done for themselves or something their family told them to do, whatever the mold is for them, do you have any advice for them helping to break free from that mold?
I will tell you, I am an advocate of following your heart. Now, I've not always done that myself. In fact, I've often followed the rules of society or what my parents' expectations were or what I thought was the right thing to do because I was a parent. But I have to tell you that when I looked back and the times of my life when I followed my heart and jumped out a little bit and took that risk, it always worked out in the end.
Yeah, it always did.
It felt risky, and sometimes when you follow your heart, it doesn't have a great plan. Or you worry the choice might not work out. But I feel if your heart says it's right and there's no evidence it's a bad decision, then it's going to turn out right. And a little bit more about what I mean there, because I'm not saying that people should just willy-nilly do whatever they feel like doing that day. I'm saying that I think that there's times where I've let my mind, and I think my clients too, their mind and the facts and fear overrides intuition.
Yep.
In my case, that didn't always turn out so well when I based it on only the facts. So for example, that story I told you earlier, where I'm a single mom and I had just gone through a divorce and I had these two kids who were like 4 years old or something around that age, and it did not make sense to take a temporary assignment, and I did it. And that kind of opened up the doors for me about, oh, follow your heart, follow your gut, follow your instinct. So when I work through these issues with my clients, I don't advise them to act on impulse, but I do ask them to not only study the facts and data, but to listen really carefully to how they're feeling. We actually spend time in session quietly, listening to their body, listening to their instincts, reading that in addition to all the data and facts, which I like. I'm an S on the Myers-Briggs, so I like data, and I like to get into that. But I'm also an F, and I also like to listen to myself.
Yeah, I love it. And thank you for sharing that, Lisa. It is really important that we take into consideration a variety of things. And thankfully, we're kind of moving to a place in society where we have more ability to just kind of be still and take time for reflection and meditate, pray, you know, do whatever it is that you need to do to listen to your body or to listen to your mind or to seek out and find those patterns a little bit more regularly. Yeah. You know, so thank you for thinking about that or saying that, is that it's okay to take some risks. It's okay to follow your heart. Oftentimes what comes from it, although initially scary, what comes from it ends up being a pretty significant blessing. I did mention BarringtonCoaching.com earlier. Is that the best place to follow you, keep an eye on you, find you, Lisa?
I think that's a place to find me. But I think really to follow me, the best place is on LinkedIn.
Okay.
So I really use LinkedIn a lot. I publish. Every time I get quoted or I publish, I make sure it's somewhere on LinkedIn. So that's a really good place. And I also put some stuff out there on Medium. And on LinkedIn, I'm Coach Lisa Barrington.
Got it. Cool. Yeah. Thank you for that. As we wrap up here, Lisa, I would just want to really, really significantly thank you for all the work that you've done over the years for different corporations, for yourself, for your family, for the folks that you've served, the certifications, the degrees. You know, good luck finishing up the dissertation. I love the stories about how you knew that this was a calling for you from the time that you were in high school and your friends and people around you were basically calling you the therapist, and that you knew that this was going to be something that really, really resonated with you. And the stories from Amex, the move into ASU, the time that you had at Banner, we're looking at all of these different things. And what do we do, right, with all of these experiences? How do we build that trust? How do we build that connection? What are we doing to really practice positive psychology and to help our clients move from place to place? And I just really, really love that you've been able to establish and build a business as a result of relationships that you've nurtured and grown over a very, very long period of time. You're pretty clear on what it is that you can do to help people, and you've got a bank of resources and knowledge and experiences to really help those people become vulnerable and to think about what's the mix between really direct and compassionate conversation with them to get them to the point of being able to move. And you've just shared a massive quantity of great resources. So thank you so much for doing that. And I really deep down agree with how do you follow your heart. So with that, Lisa, thank you so much for your time today. The stuff that you have shared has just been phenomenal.
Thank you, Michael. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Lisa and my conversation today. This has been another tremendous episode of Equal Chance to Be Unequal. I wish you a tremendous morning, afternoon, evening, whatever it is for you, wherever you're listening from. Thank you for listening to this episode of Equal Chance to Be Unequal. I'm Michael S. Siever. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on iTunes and like, share, or comment on this podcast on michaelsiever.com, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, or YouTube. Go forth and be awesome.